Our gospel reading comes from Matthew chapter 14, beginning at verse 14. Praise and glory to God. When Jesus landed and saw a large crowd, he had compassion on them and healed their sick. As evening approached, the disciples came to him and said, "This is a remote place and it's already getting late. Send the crowds away so they can go to the villages and buy themselves some food." Jesus replied, "You do not need to send them away. You give them something to eat." "We have here only 5 loaves of bread and 2 fish," they answered. "Bring them here to me," he said. And he directed the people to sit down on the grass. Taking the 5 loaves and the 2 fish and looking up to heaven, he gave thanks and broke the loaves. Then he gave them to the disciples, and the disciples gave them to the people. They all ate and were satisfied. And the disciples picked up 12 baskets full of broken pieces that were left over. The number of those who ate was about 5,000 men, besides women and children. This is the gospel of Christ. Praise to Christ the Word.
And Rob and I don't really do sermons in the traditional way. We have what we call documented discussions. Rob and I like to get together over a cup of tea or a curry or over WhatsApp and have many conversations about faith and other things. And so we document some of these discussions. And so that's a wee bit of what we're doing today. And we're talking about finding connection. And just before, because we had quite a few conversations about this idea of how we connect to the world around us and how we connect to God. And it's cool to be sitting here today with our strongest connections, both our sets of parents here. It's great to be here with you all. But to acknowledge that, here's one of our strongest connections sitting right amongst us, and it's a real pleasure for Rob and I to be here with our parents. So thanks to our parents for visiting here or being here. So yeah, it's cool to have that. And a disclaimer on their behalf, on their behalf, that anything they say does not reflect anything about their parenting.
When I was a vicar's son here, we used to get calls, and I would answer the phone and they would hear a male voice and they'd say, "Is that the Reverend Boyd?" And I'd say, "No, it's the Irreverent Boyd." So.
There we go. To get us underway, I'm just going to show you some photos. This is the Button family batch. Now, if you know Mum and Dad, you've heard them talking about the Button family batch in Maruia. So here it is. In fact, Mum was up there yesterday with my brother fixing up the roof, which you can see here, just needed a little repair done on it. It was a lovely day. It was like that yesterday, wasn't it, Mum? A lovely sunny day at the Bats yesterday. So this is not just a picture of a place. It might just be a picture for you, but for Mum and Dad and I and my brothers, it represents so much, so many memories, whether it was when I was a young child, with being up there with Mum and Dad and my brothers, or with my wife and my children. Just so many memories there, a place that I feel happier than anywhere else. It's a place of recovery, a place where I can relax and I can unwind. But as well as that, I can explore and create. There's so many great walks. I remember being young and Mum taking us on lots of walks through bush that we didn't really know where we were going, but we got there in the end, didn't we, Mum? We always knew where we were going. It's a place I felt safe. It's what you might call your turanga waiwai, a Māori word. So that's the view from the bench. Used to having different screens around all over the place. That's a lovely view looking up just from where you sit in the batch. And here's another photo coming. I'm not sure where I'm going to point. Oops, I might have to go back. I might have pressed it twice. So that's the batch many years ago. Whoops, I did go back. I'll just go back that one. And there's Mum and Dad sitting at the top of the hill. Mum with a cheeky look on her face. Who knows what she was thinking at the time. But there's us boys when we were young outside the batch, and there's my children. And one of our favourite pastimes up there is being on the river and liloing down the river, Station Creek. It's a great place for us, a place where I feel grounded, a place where I feel connected. When I'm there, I don't feel disconnected. I don't feel isolated. What about you, Rob?
Yeah, so we have a batch as well. There's a view out of the window. Mum and Dad had the house for many years, and my wife and I bought it off them, and they had a house over there ever since Dad was the vicar here. And it's at Diamond Harbour, so that's a view looking out over the harbour. And again, it's a place of peace and quiet. My brother and I used to explore down the gullies. I don't think Mum knew where we used to get to, really. We used to go disappearing off for hours, building huts and climbing down cliffs, and it's probably remarkable I'm still here. But other things, you know, I also love Dad's Army. It was my grandfather's favourite program. And he was actually in the Home Guard during the Second World War. I like old rock songs, some of which date back to when I was going to this church. And it reminds me I was once marginally stylish and trend conscious. And my wife makes me feel secure. She's a bit cleverer than me and has got a knack of sorting things out for me.
So we've just talked about some things that ground Rob and I, the places, our batches, but also people, songs, TV programs, and I wonder whether you might just take a moment, just with maybe the person near you, next to you, to reflect on for you, do you have any points of connection that you can think of? As I say, it doesn't need to be a place, it could be a person, it could be it could be anything you might want it to be. So maybe just take a moment, we'll just take a minute or so, just to talk to the person next to you, think about what's a grounding, safe place for you? Just take a moment. Okay, we'll draw you back. Without needing to explain why this is your grounding thing, what were some of the things that you were talked about as being your connections, your grounding points? And they didn't bite, now you've become one. So there you go. No, that's good. A place. Any other ones? Any other ones that people shared? Yep. The beach, the sea. Yeah, nice. Great. Nice. Like it. You can see when we talk about points of grounding and connection for us, they can be quite different. So it doesn't, you know, just because there is one doesn't mean that we'll all relate to it. For example, Mary's friend, I don't know her, so I can't exactly relate to her, but I relate to the idea of it. So we realise that the points of connections are really very meaningful and personal, aren't they? They mean a lot to us. So whether it's a person, a place, an item, a way of doing things, they provide a connection for us, a place where we feel safe and secure. I'm just looking here at John, just thinking about an organ or a piano is another place. That might be a place we might find that as well. If these experiences, sorry, I'm just jumping ahead. In a world where we can feel quite alone at times and there's so much uncertainty around us, we can feel quite helpless and hopeless. So these things play a particularly important part to us being well, our well-being, don't they? And keeping us feeling like we belong. And in a similar way, our faith in God is also a connection and a grounding in our lives. And getting to know God is very much like getting to know anyone else. That is, we have experiences of the other, of God in this case. If those experiences we have of God seem real and tangible to us, we remember them, we connect with them, we recall them of part of what we know about God. Our experience of God could be of God being close at hand when we felt alone. It could be even while the reading, you know, we're hearing a reading being done and we hear something, you know, that's my experience, I hear God in the reading, in the Bible, like in that psalm, which great psalm that we read together. Might be in the beauty of creation, like being at the beach, the beauty of a song, like Rob was talking about, or an overwhelming peace that is just sure of God's grace in our lives, or it could be some other people around us. All these experiences build our knowledge and of God. But there can also be things that we do here at church, right? Things that remind us of those experiences and connections. Whether it's the gathering together, as we are here today in this place, it might be the way we do things here together. So it's the coming to the place, the way we do things, the things we value, and particularly our relationships to the people around us. we're reminded of those things we know and love God for, which again grounds us and helps us to feel connected. As Dad said in the prayer at the start of the service, that we might, through the service today, gain strength to go and be in the world again. We might be grounded and connected again. So for me personally, some aspects of church life that I know and love God for are things like church camps. We're from St. Aidan's Church, we have church camps, and we have great times there. Singing worship songs, particular worship songs, where I feel like God's reaching out to me, calming me. When we share the peace together, that can be another time I experience that and know God to be there. And also the love and spirit of shared amongst the people of church together. All those things help me to stay grounded and connected. And lastly, real and honest conversations are crucial for me. This is in terms of church life, that is, where we talk about all of our doubts and our fears, our battles, our high points, our low points, whether it's in a sermon, whether it's in the prayers, when we're singing, or more likely, actually, it's when we have a cup of tea afterwards. These times are actually really important to me. It always feels to me like God is closer at hand when the conversation is about how we are in reality, with all our doubts and battles, not how we should just be in theory. At these times I feel a little less helpless and hopeless about the world, as though I'm not alone facing the giants. And what about you, Rob?
Yeah, so I have a sense of security in the Anglican worship style, which obviously is what I grew up with. But in a very large part these days, it's also a sense of family with our family at St. Aidan's. But for me, because Dad was the vicar here for 10 years, I have some relationship to this church too. Many members of the family that I remember from being here are commemorated now on plaques in the memorial wall outside. Sometimes I come past with our dog, Clive, and say hello to people. And I have fond memories of climbing round inside the bell tower and on the roof of the hall when I was more agile. That used to lead to some trouble. But as we're saying, for other people it may be different. Different key connections in the family, different aspects of the worship, preaching, music, etc. But as we look around our gathering now, and you know, in so many churches across the diocese, we recognise that clearly there are a lot of ages and cultures that are not connected here. Something like the way younger people may not connect with older pop songs or Dad's Army because their grandfather was not in the war. It's not wrong, but it's different. And, you know, Matt and I caused chaos at the 8 o'clock service when we lined up like we do at St. Aidan's to receive communion. But actually in this church you line out across here, so caused chaos. The obvious group we see missing probably in our experience is our own children. Maybe there are some aspects of a church service or life that lack meaning and connection for them, even though they work for some or all of us. And one example we thought of is there unessential religious jargon that's putting people off? Do people know what some of the phrases and words we talk about mean? As pointed out by some people, sometimes we say things in an odd way. For example, you would have heard prayers where every second word is just, but we never usually have conversations with our friends like that. Or we use phrases that mean something to us, but not to others, maybe from outside a church background, and perhaps to some degree have lost their relevance. What does it mean, for example, when someone says, "Let's fellowship on this"? And even the word sin is not a word or a concept in today's culture. So if people come in the door and encounter some of this, will they relate and connect into our church?
Challenging words. It's no surprise, though, that we all have our ways of doing things, our language and our traditions, as we all do. Without them, we'd be quite a muddled mess, really, and we're all over the place. So our brains are definitely wired to bring order where there is disorder, to make it make sense to us. And when we find order, we feel less threatened and less confused when we know what's coming next. Like we're just, what you're just saying about the aisle of how do you do communion? Like, it's nice when you know what to do. When we were at 8, we didn't know what to do. We may have messed it up a bit. But anyway, it's all right. But, we try and find order in these things. So there is a natural resistance in us around change, isn't there? We don't really want to change anything that may unsettle our insecurity, our security and our comfort. But, you know, the question is, what if God is asking us to give up a little of that comfort and to join him in something new? Sometimes we may need to pick up our mat and walk into a new life, leaving behind some things that are no longer needed. Which leads very nicely into this Old Testament story about a tent.
So when we were having our discussion before we went into this, we were discussing the idea of packing up and going somewhere new. The idea that came to my mind was the tent of the tabernacle in the Old Testament. And it was used by the Jews as they migrated out of Egypt to the Promised Land as a place of connecting with God. But as the reading we heard in the reading this morning, the tent didn't stay in one place, but we'd be moved around to follow where God, as seen in the cloud, had moved. They would pack up their whole camp and move to wherever the presence of God had moved to. So while the tent stayed the same, where it was didn't. I wonder why God moved his presence around. Perhaps God didn't want his presence to be locked into one place. He recognized we have a tendency to turn stuff into idols of comfort. God's objective was actually to move the Israelites to the Promised Land, not let them get stuck and comfortable in their location and their knowledge as it was. He wanted them watching, listening, creating, recreating, moving and connecting according to his ultimate plan.
So I suppose one of the greatest risks in church is that we and those before us have the things that we've found as grounding and connecting can become entrenched or enshrined or locked in, becoming a religion in themselves. There's a bishop called Leslie Newbegin, an old bishop who wrote these words. You enjoy that one? that's not Leslie Newbegin. I think you know who that is. Let's see, I've just forgotten to click through. Here we go. It's quite small, but I'll just read this out. It's from a book by Leslie Newbegin. Religion can become the enemy of faith. The forms of religion can become an occasion for idolatry. That is to say, we can come to regard them as the means by which a certain aspect of life that we call religious is handled with safety and propriety, is kept under control and management. But the living God, he whose self-revealing these religious forms express and commemorate, is not susceptible to being kept under proper control and management. He is free, with depths beyond all human comprehension of creativity, resourcefulness, and goodness. Now, I recognise, A, that's small writing, and B, it's a very dense paragraph, but it's also pretty confronting, I think. Could our efforts to manage church life actually be the enemy of faith? As I reflect on that, I wonder, and I feel threatened by, what is it that I might need to change? What is it that I might need to leave behind at the old campsite? But the positive part of me wants to reread the last little bit of that, which says, God is free with depths of all human comprehension of creativity. It reminds me that creativity is such an important and exciting aspect and characteristic of God. He wants us to be creative about how we connect to him and how we encourage others to connect to him. What's your take on that bit from the book, Rob?
Yeah, that is quite dense. I had to read that about three times. So I can recall going to the odd service, not generally in the Anglican tradition, but where there's an emphasis on some sort of spiritual high. So possibly by nature and science training, I'm a bit suspicious of that. Not so much that it can't happen, but more that it's mandated, it has to happen in the service. Again, God's not constrained by our patterns, he's more honest and creative. The New Testament stories to me seem very simple. Crowds of people wanted to come and meet Jesus. He would even welcome women and children and lepers, people of other faiths. And once people showed up, he made his points by simple and sometimes funny stories. So the church has called them parables, So do other people know what that word actually means? And they were grounded in the everyday life of the times. Are there kind and creative ways that people would find more relevant and attractive today? So one service we had recently at St. Aidan's, Craig Dixon decided we would have a Beatles song. So we sang Here Comes the Sun. So it was flipped round to take on different meaning, and sometimes we can appropriate things creatively from the culture because they reflect other people seeking connection with something above. My daughter Michelle tells me from her social work training there is a universal need for people to seek connection and belonging. So while the Beatles was cool for me, for others it might be an artwork or photography, or for many of us a big parish lunch. But to me there's also a warning in this. There's a historian, Tom Holland, who's written a book recently. He was an atheist and he studied culture and history, and he thinks our whole culture, and he's got good reason, has been influenced and made better by Christianity, especially when compared to the other dominant cultures of Jesus' day that could theoretically equally have had as much influence. So actually, he's so convinced by his thesis that he ended up going back to church. But one implication to me is that God will have his way in the long run. Society and lives by Christianity have been changed creatively. So we as a church need to either get on board and connect with people and with God and move on to achieve his purposes. Perhaps God even uses some discontentment to get us shifted, maybe even some pain. As C.S. Lewis said, God whispers in our pleasures, speaks in our conscience, but shouts to us in our pain. It is his megaphone to rouse a deaf world. And you can see this in Ukraine. People are coming back to God. Terrible situation, but people are realizing. I wonder if the current pains in churches are part of God trying to get us shifted and work more creatively on connecting with people in the current age.
Yeah. So where have we got to so far? We've acknowledged that we have these connections to our world around us, things that are important to ground us, and we have these similar connections to God, things that are helpful and beneficial. But what might be beneficial to us may not necessarily be beneficial to others, as seen by what we can see around us here today. But when it comes, as I say, to how we connect with God, we've got to be cautious. There is a risk that the very things that ground us may not ground others. It's quite challenging to think about what we may need to do to move our tent to where God might be calling us now, because we acknowledge it is threatening to our sense of security and safety. I guess the question is perhaps not to get stuck into critiquing every single aspect of church life, but rather to think creatively how we might help our communities connect and experience God here. And by our communities, I mean our local community, but I mean our whānau. I mean our children, our siblings, our parents, our friends, and our network, our work colleagues. What might help them experience a little less helplessness, hopelessness, and isolation? So that's where we've got to so far, but for now we need to conclude with the story of the tent, because there is an ending to it.
So God recognised the tent and the temple were okay for the Jews, and he wanted everyone connected. But he wanted everyone connected. So in the New Testament, our place of meeting has now become Jesus. The relationship has become the place of meeting, not the tent or the format, which is crafty of God, really, because he's looking to satisfy both the relational and the God-seeking holes in our psyche. But this means we need to move on to meet Jesus and continually move on as a relationship with him grows and changes, as all human relationships do change and grow. Some things that may have been important in the past may become less so. So how do we move our tent to help connect with Jesus? So we've come up with 4 points, not the standard 3. Are we being asked to move our tent and modify the unessentials to ensure we have relevant connection in today's world? People have more access to information, both good and bad, than ever before, yet we live in a society of disconnection and broken relationships. Can we offer something here, given connection is what Jesus is about? God is looking to build a family, and we can relax and enjoy being part of that. And other people will see this as something different. People from all sorts of backgrounds that might never normally mix are held together by love with our connectedness as a witness. As it says, they'll know we're Christians by our love. But equally, the splits and divisions in churches, which I know you guys have experienced, is not a witness to being one in love.
The second point is, are we clear on who this Jesus fellow is? You know, given Jesus is the place of connection, are we clear who he is? Because some people don't think he even existed. And for us, the discussion of the book about Tom Holland on the impact of Jesus on our society was a clear demonstration of the relevance and impact of Jesus. It's so clear. Maybe some people are actually interested in historical evidence, such as the logic that C.S. Lewis talked about with the trilemma, Jesus was either a lunatic, a liar, or God.
Third point is, it's becoming more clear to me as I get older that God is nice and he actually likes me in an unconditional way, which is very reassuring. Jesus was not aloof. He didn't expect a standard of dress. He didn't require any particular language. Didn't expect people to be all sorted out. There was a sense of him being non-threatening and warm, attributes that encourage connection. I like the idea that kindness helps people find God, which Adrian Plass said, because that is a practical behaviour we can all have a shot at. And so the challenge is to consider how we can do the same in our churches. How can we lessen the things that are threatening and unfamiliar and increase the things where kindness and unconditional acceptance and warmth attract people? And the fourth thing is, sometimes change is good. We all like fine weather, summer weather. We like barbecues. Well, I do. Most other people do. We like being outside in the heat. But I remember one day in February, where it rained after a couple of 30-degree days, and you can hear the drumming of the rain on the roof, and you see the falling drops, and you the smell of the water on the hot earth. Sometimes what we wouldn't change itself actually brings refreshment and a sense of liberation when we do change it.
We probably wouldn't mind a February day right now, would we? that's all we've got to bring, so thank you.
Thank you.
Amen.